provide something that is easy to simply purchase and rent out. Therefore, when you invest in a fixer-upper, you clear out the vast majority of the competition because most people simply do not want to do the work needed to bring a home up to par. Instead of competing with 100% of the population, you are competing with perhaps 10% of those who are willing to look at fixer-uppers. This can make finding a deal much easier, even in a hot market. Forced appreciation. I also love fixer-uppers because you can build some immediate equity in the property through a concept known as forced appreciation. Earlier in the book, I talked about the four wealth generators of real estate: appreciation, cash flow, tax savings, and the loan paydown. Appreciation is a concept that properties tend to gain value over time. But what if I wanted to shorten that time? What if I didn't want to wait 20 years for inflation to push my property value up? While it is very difficult to raise the value of a nice home, it is possible to raise the value of a fixer-upper and take advantage of this amazing wealth generator called appreciation. For example, 3 years ago, I purchased my own primary residence for $62,000, and it was a fixer-upper. It needed paint, flooring, some foundation work, new windows, new counters, and a whole lot more. I ended up putting about $20,000 worth of work into the property, so I currently have approximately $82,000 into the home. However, the home is now worth $82,000. As soon as I finished the rehab, it became worth what other fixed-up homes of its size and condition are worth in my neighborhood, about $132,000. So I was able to raise the value of the home from $62,000 to $132,000 through just the power of rehab. Now I will be able to take further advantage of that great wealth generator we call appreciation, which is guided by inflation and the real estate market, from a starting point of $132,000 rather than the $62,000. In other words, if the market appreciates 2% per year, it's going up by 2% from $132,000, so $134,640 next year, $137,333 the following year, $140,000 the following year, and so on. My wealth creation was supercharged through the power of buying a fixer-upper. Potentially more cash flow. Because fixer-uppers allow you to buy a property for far less than other properties in the area, a fixer-upper can also help you achieve greater cash flow. To illustrate what I mean, let's return to the story I just shared about my own primary residence. Had I purchased this home for the full value of what it was worth, my ability to earn any extra cash flow from the property would have been severely diminished, because my mortgage payment would have been much higher. Instead, my mortgage is cheap enough that if I rented the home out today, I would be renting it out for what a $132,000 house would rent for, but I would only be paying a mortgage on an $82,000 house because I refinanced to an $82,000 loan, getting all my rehab money back. Therefore, my cash flow is being supercharged because I bought a fixer-upper. Unique financing options. Finally, one of the reasons I like fixer-uppers so much is the unique financing ideas they can offer. I'll also discuss financing in the con section for fixer-uppers, but let's first talk about how fixer-uppers can lend themselves to greater financial options. Although most lenders do not lend on properties that need a lot of work, I found a unique way to invest in fixer-uppers that allow me to ultimately get the rental properties for very little of my own cash. To accomplish this, I find a great deal, get a private lender or hard money lender to finance the purchase and hopefully the rehab, and then after a seasoning period of 6 to 12 months, I refinance the home into a long-term mortgage. I call this the BRRRR strategy for buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat, which I outlined in Chapter 3. I recently accomplished this with the purchase of a fiveplex in my town. The property was listed at $120,000. It had been reduced from a starting point of $150,000. And I offered the seller, a local bank, $90,000 for the property, and they accepted. The property needed about $10,000 worth of work, mostly interior and exterior paint, some carpet, and some cleaning. To fund the purchase of the property, I called a friend I met on Bigger Pockets who I knew lent money to individuals on short-term rehabs. He agreed to fund the entire $90,000 purchase price if I funded the rehab costs. A little over 1 year later, I went to a local bank and refinanced or obtained a new loan for $90,000 to pay off the friend from Bigger Pockets. In the end, I have about $10,000 invested into the deal, with cash flow of $800 per month, and have about $60,000 of equity built into the property. All this was made possible because it was a fixer-upper. Now, before you go out and buy a fixer-upper because of what I just said, let's talk about some of the dangers, risks, and disadvantages, because there are many. Cons. Hidden expenses. Anytime you open up a wall, rip up a floor covering, remove part of a roof, or undertake another rehab project on a fixer-upper, you increase the risk of finding more that needs to be fixed. For example, you might decide that you need new cabinets, but suddenly you realize that you also need new electrical work in the wall behind those cabinets. Maybe you'll discover some lead-based paint. Maybe you'll find rotten wood. The point is this. It is very difficult, especially as a new investor, to accurately estimate the total cost of a rehab on a project. Stress. Rehabbing a home is usually not a peaceful experience. From the first swing of the hammer to the final change of the locks, dealing with the drama associated with rehabbing can be stressful. If you plan to do the work yourself, plan on coming home each day with cuts, bruises, and a lot of frustration. If you plan on hiring it out, expect to deal with contractors who say one thing and do another, show up late, and miss deadlines. As you get more proficient at rehabbing a home, it can become an easier task, but learning how to efficiently rehab a house takes time. Potentially more out-of-pocket costs. Because of the two items I just mentioned, maintaining your budget while rehabbing a home is difficult. The same applies for maintaining your timeline. Therefore, when investing in fixer-uppers, it is easy to spend more money than you planned and for the project to take longer, thus throwing your analysis out the window. This can affect your ROI and turn a great deal into no deal at all. Five questions to ask before investing in a fixer-upper. So, should you invest in a fixer-upper? Well, despite the cons I outlined, I would actually say yes, you should definitely consider it because of the overwhelming pros. However, before you jump into your next project, ask yourself these five questions about the deal. Number one, how bad is it? There are many levels of severity when dealing with fixer-uppers. Some properties need just a few thousand dollars worth of paint, while others need a complete overhaul. As common sense would suggest, the less work a property needs, the less risk you'll have that something will go wrong during the rehab. At the same time, however, the less work a property needs, the more competition you'll face. This is why I generally look for properties that appear to need a lot of work to the general public, but that actually just need minor fixes. For example, homes that have a bad smell because of pets or cigarettes are a prime candidate for me, because smells are easy to rectify. An ugly exterior paint job or a bad roof are also fairly easy, if costly, to remedy, but they scare away most potential homeowners. So before you buy a fixer-upper, I encourage you to really look at the property and have an accurate estimate of what it is going to take to fix it up. Don't go into a fixer-upper blind. Number two, is it worth it? Let me ask you a question. Is it better to buy a house for $120,000 that needs $30,000 worth of repairs, or a house that is $150,000 and is 100% finished? Well, with all other factors being equal, the finished house clearly has the advantage. However, many investors fail to comprehend this logic and instead think fixer-upper automatically means great deal, but it doesn't. Often, the cost of rehabbing a project will negate any discount you might get. On the other hand, if you could get that same property for $90,000 and put $30,000 into it, and now make it worth $150,000, well, now we're talking. Number three, do I have the time? Whether you plan to do the work yourself or not, fixer-uppers take time. You have to be present at the property often to make sure the work is being finished correctly, or maybe you'll end up having to do the work yourself. I have a friend who bought a fixer-upper triplex with plans to live in one unit and rent the other two out. But it took him 3 years to fix the other two units up to get them rented. While this friend may still have a great investment on his hands, he lost close to $40,000 in potential rent over those 3 years because he didn't have time to handle a fixer-upper. Number four, do I have the skills? Most people who are looking to get started with fixer-upper rental properties plan to do the work themselves. I actually encourage this as long as the work is on a small scale. Being able to do your own rehab can save you a ton of money and can help you get a good feel for how long projects take so you can better manage the hiring out of those projects in the future. However, if this is your plan, do you really have the skills to take on the project? If not, see the next question in this list. Number five, do I have the drive? Or more importantly, do you have the mental skill and motivation needed to learn how to accomplish those projects? My first home was a fixer-upper, and I had never swung a hammer in my life. However, I picked up a book on home improvement and began learning on the job. I also called in a lot of favors from other people I knew and had them teach me how to do things. By the end of the project, I can install carpet, tile a bathroom, lay laminate wood flooring, solder copper pipes, and fix a leaky roof. Not because I had the skill, but because I had the desire and the motivation to acquire those skills. By answering these five questions for every project you are about to take on, you can better decide whether it is the right path for you. Fixer-uppers can be a great way to supercharge your wealth creation, but they also present increased risk. Just be sure to do your due diligence on any fixer-upper you plan to buy and accurately account for the hurdles you might face. Then, take action and get a little dirty. Commercial real estate. Commercial real estate consists of property leased to businesses for work purposes rather than individuals for living space. Doctor's offices, grocery stores, strip malls, restaurants, the building that houses the local Starbucks, the office building down the street, and hundreds of other buildings that house businesses fall within the commercial real estate realm. Commercial real estate can be advantageous because they require less hands-on interaction from the owner. After all, a commercial tenant is not likely to call to complain about the neighbor being noisy or the toilet being clogged, or to give excuses about why the rent is late. Though, depending on the commercial tenant, all these could be a possibility. As a result of their more stable nature, commercial real estate tends to offer lower returns, but this may be ideal for an investor later in their real estate career. Commercial properties also usually require a higher down payment, 30% or more, and may encounter much longer periods of vacancy. When you own a single family house, there are generally thousands of potential families waiting to move in. When you own a specialized commercial property, the property's shape and size may mean only one kind of tenant could ever move there, which in turn means it might sit vacant for months or even years before the right tenant comes along. One of the most popular types of commercial investments is known as triple net or NNN. In a triple net lease, the commercial tenant pays for nearly every single expense, including maintenance, improvements, remodeling, capital expenditures, insurance, and taxes. This can be one of the most passive real estate methods on earth, but as such, the return will likely also be significantly lower than you might see in other, more active niches. Although there are certain principles within this book that relate to commercial real estate investing, most of my experience lies in residential, so that is where I'll keep my focus. Wrapping it up. The goal of this chapter was to give you an in-depth look at the most common types of rental properties a person can invest in. Next time somebody asks you, what kind of real estate do you want to invest in? You won't need to stumble around for an answer like an 18-year-old kid trying to impress his girlfriend's dad. There is no one right path you to take. Rather, the type of real estate you choose to invest in will depend on the kind of real estate that works well in your area, with your budget, within your time frame, and with your skill set. In truth, any of these types of rental properties could help you achieve financial freedom and independence. So which will you choose? In addition, you are not limited to just one of these types. My first deal was a single-family house. My second was a duplex. Within a few years, I had purchased a 24-unit apartment complex, and now I'm looking at more commercial properties. A diverse real estate portfolio is definitely possible, but each type of rental property requires a whole new set of rules, so I would recommend starting with one type and expanding as you gain experience. So hopefully now you have a solid grasp on the different types of investment properties you could buy. However, one thing matters even more than the type of investment, and that is a location. Even a great investment, if purchased in a poor area, could turn into a horrific experience. But how do you find the best location? Well, let's find out in the next chapter. Chapter 8. Location, location, location. Even in a bad market, location, location, location is still a way to buy and sell property. Vanilla Ice. Recently, my wife and I had a fantastic opportunity to take a road trip around the entire U.S., leaving Seattle and driving to New York City, down the East Coast, and across the South. For almost 5 weeks, we rode and often slept in our little Prius, traversing through the mountains, deserts, forests, and more cornfields than I knew existed. This trip was definitely one of the highlights of my life, and not just because of the scenery. But along the way, we met with hundreds of real estate investors from the Bigger Pockets community, hearing their stories of real estate success and struggles. I talked with Josh and Summer, a young couple from Montana who were beginning to build wealth through a small duplex they created by moving a mobile home onto the same land as a single-family house. I met with Jared in Ohio, whose knowledge of the construction industry allowed him to buy more than 20 rental units before his 25th birthday. I talked to CC in New York, who is buying brownstone townhouses in New York City to craft his financial independence in a market where most people consider it too expensive. Real estate investing is possible in any market and in any location, as these people have demonstrated. However, understanding the location you are investing in is key to being successful with that investment. Each of the stories I just mentioned demonstrate a different style of real estate investing crafted out of the location each investor found themselves in. Your investing journey will likewise be specific to you and your location. You need to gain an in-depth understanding of the location you plan to invest in so you can find a strategy that will work best for you there. That is the goal of this chapter, to help you master the concept of location. In this chapter, I will explain several key indicators that define an area's strength. Keep in mind that money can be made in any real estate market and in pretty much any location. The purpose of this section is not to give you a checklist of where you should and should not buy, but to help you know what to look out for and to consider when analyzing a location, as well as provide you with some links to resources where you can investigate indicators more thoroughly. Neighborhood classes. As you begin investing in real estate, you'll likely hear people talk about a property being in an A, B, C, or D location. Just like your high school class grades, a neighborhood can receive a grade, though the classification is a bit more subjective than a simple high school test. There is no government organization, board, or company that classifies locations. It's honestly more of an unwritten rule accepted by most investors, and the lines are not incredibly clear. You might think a location is an A location, the best, while I might think it's a B location, the second best. But for the most part, investors will agree on the class distinctions. Some investors grade locations on an A through C scale, whereas others grade on an A through F scale. In other words, you might say a location is a C location, meaning that you think it's the worst because you grade on an A through C scale. At the same time, somebody who grades on an A through F scale might think it's pretty middle of the road. For the sake of our discussion in this chapter, we'll use an A through D scale, which is probably the most common grading scale you'll hear. In addition to the location receiving the grade, the property itself can be classified as an A, B, C, or D property. So you might hear someone say, "I have an A property in a B area." To add more specificity to the classification system, some will add a plus or a minus to those grades. So you might hear, "The property is a B minus house in a B plus area." I'll leave out the plus and minus designations in this chapter, but you can always use them if you want to get fancy or more specific. So let's take a minute and talk about those different classes of locations and property types. Class A. A Class A location is an area that has the newest buildings, the hottest restaurants, the best schools, the wealthiest people, and the highest cost real estate. This is truly the best location you can find, and the highest quality tenants are looking to rent here. A Class A building follows the same concept. It is generally newer, probably less than 10 years old, and therefore has fewer maintenance issues. The building has modern amenities, such as granite countertops, hardwood floors, and other in-demand features. Class A properties generally command the highest rent, but may provide a lower amount of cash flow because of the high demand for an easy investment. Class B. A Class B location might be slightly older than a Class A one, but perhaps still has decent restaurants, schools, and people. This might be your middle-class area, but these will attract more blue-collar workers who live a little more paycheck to paycheck. A Class B building follows the same concept. It is probably 15 to 30 years old, mostly upgraded, but perhaps lacking the shine of a Class A property. Rental income is probably lower than what you might find with a Class A property, and the maintenance cost will likely be a little higher because of the age of the home. Class C. A Class C location is likely a lower income area with homes that are old, 30 years or more. This area tends to attract people who are either on government subsidies or working lower wage jobs. You'll likely find a lot of check cashing businesses, pawn shops, and other such businesses in the area. A Class C building follows the same concept. The property is likely older than 30 years old and looks the part. Numerous repairs are likely needed and ongoing maintenance should be expected. Systems in the property, such as plumbing and electrical, may be outdated and require ongoing attention. Properties will typically rent for a low amount in this area, But properties will also be much more affordable than Class A or B. Class D. A Class D location is a war zone where you likely wouldn't want to go alone. Not every city has a Class D area, but you'll likely recognize one when you see it. Often, even cops are nervous about entering these areas, and crime and drug use and sales run rampant. There are probably numerous buildings with boarded up windows and other indications of being vacant. A Class D building is likely old, similar to a Class C, but with far more neglect. Chances are the property is currently uninhabitable, needing significant repairs before it can be lived in. Class D properties are generally exceptionally cheap, but getting good tenants can be difficult and dangerous. Unless you really know what you're doing, I don't recommend getting involved with a Class D building or location. As I mentioned earlier, the class distinctions are not very rigid or defined, but the classifications I just outlined here should give you a general indication of how investors view properties and neighborhoods. While doing research for this book, I stumbled upon a humorously accurate interpretation of the four classes written by Matt R. on the Bigger Pockets forums, as you can see in figure 6 at biggerpockets.com/rental-book-figures. But I'll read it for you here. Matt R. says, "Great question. Here is my newbie take on the subject. A, you and your family would live in it. B, you and your family could live in it. C, you and your family could live in it if it was an emergency. D, you would rather be camping." There is no right or wrong answer to the question, what classification should I invest in? You'll likely find investors who only buy A, others who only buy B, others who only buy C, and still others who only buy D. God help them. Each has pros and cons. Typically, the nicer properties will cost the most, but may produce the least amount of headache. Though this is not always true. Because I am largely a value-add investor, someone looking to rehab a property and bring its value up, I tend to look for a Class C property in a Class B area. But you'll likely find a strategy that works well for you. Now that I've introduced you to the concept of location classification, let's move on and talk in depth about some of the different location characteristics that help define an area. Crime. An area with a lot of crime can make finding and keeping good tenants difficult for a rental property owner. Therefore, it is important to understand the criminal activity of the location you want to invest in. There are several great tools you can use to help you investigate the criminal activity in a particular area. I recommend the following online resources. CrimeReports.com, free. NeighborhoodScout.com, paid. City-Data.com, free. USA.com/rank, free. Each of these sites will allow you to access in-depth information on the volume and type of crime in an area. I recommend beginning with crimereports.com and typing in a zip code of the area you want to invest in. You'll see a crime map of that area that shows robberies, thefts, assaults, murders, sex offenders, and other offenses. For example, the following is a map in figure 7 at biggerpockets.com/rental-book-figures of the town of Aberdeen, where I have several rental properties. I can see that the bulk of the criminal activity in this area is located north of the river, but the south side is relatively safe. When you are driving around the area in person, however, both areas look similar. So a person would likely not know about the difference in crime without a map like this. As a result, I'm much more inclined to buy a property in the south side area than in the north part because of the crime. Keep in mind, crime maps, while helpful, don't show the kind of invisible borders that exist in a community. For example, let's say that there is a four-block area in the middle of your town where crime is high. On the crime map, you can see that most of the crime takes place within the zone. But what about immediately outside the zone? There may not be a lot of crime here, but the proximity to the high crime area may make finding good tenants just as hard as in the crime area. Or perhaps the general public's perception of the area is that the bad area is confined to this smaller footprint. You see, a crime map can't give you the public's perception. Only talking with locals can help you know that. Drugs. High drug abuse locations are a bit more difficult to determine, but generally speaking, drug abuse is highly related to the criminal activities in an area. High crime areas tend to have the most trouble with illegal drugs. To get more specific, honestly, the best way to know is by simply talking to people in the area. Head to a local grocery store and ask people about the area. Drug abuse affects many families, so most people will have an idea of where the high drug use areas are. You can also call your local police station and ask to speak with an officer who can shed some light on the areas of your town with the most drug abuse problems. Schools. In doing research for this book, I posed a question on the BiggerPockets forums about what indicators people consider when deciding on a location. Although I received dozens of responses, the number one response that was mentioned over and over and over again was great schools. Personally, not having children of my own yet, I didn't even realize how important this aspect is to people, but it makes absolute sense. People will typically do anything for their children, so getting them into a good public school is incredibly important for many parents. Since the school a student is assigned to is based on location, a property located near a good school district should rent for a higher amount and maintain a lower vacancy than one near a bad school district. To research school districts, head to greatschools.org and simply type in the address or zip code for your potential rental property. Great Schools gives each school a rating based on test scores and other available data, including student academic growth and college readiness. According to the Great Schools website, the Great Schools rating is on a 1 to 10 scale, where 10 is the highest and 1 is the lowest. Ratings are broken down into three categories. Ratings 1 through 3 signal that the school is below average, 4 through 7 indicate average, and 8 through 10 are above average. Jobs versus unemployment. In general, a high number of jobs make for a strong rental market, whereas high levels of unemployment can make it more difficult to find tenants who consistently pay their rent. While you may hear things like, the national unemployment rate is at 5.9%, this really means very little for you and for your rental properties. You need to get more specific and look at the unemployment rate in your city. To do this, you could dig around the United States Department of Labor's website, which operates exactly how you'd imagine a government website would operate, but I usually just head over to www.city-data.com and look up your city to discover your local unemployment rate. Again, keep in mind that higher unemployment does not necessarily mean you shouldn't invest there. My area currently has a 9.9% unemployment rate, which is 50% higher than the Washington state average. While that seems terribly high, remember that this also means that we have a 90.1% employment rate. So 90% of our population is employed. A higher unemployment rate just means I need to screen my tenants even better than I normally might to make sure they are in the 90% who are employed. And I need to make sure that their job is a high likelihood of lasting. In other words, that their job is not a temporary one. Population growth. A growing population should allow you to raise rents over time and should also increase the value of your property through appreciation because of supply and demand. Yes, you know that I advocate buying primarily for cash flow when investing in rental properties and that appreciation is the icing on the cake. But why not buy cash flowing properties in areas that have the highest chance for getting that icing? Population growth is impossible to predict with 100% accuracy, but educated guesses can be made based on historical data and current trends. To research population historical data, I like to head to www.usa.com/rank, where you can enter your target market's zip code to see data like population, population growth, and population density, and to learn where your city ranks among other cities in your state. You can also research the fastest growing cities in your area to spot trends. Housing starts and building permits. Another key indicator of population growth and of the potential for appreciation with your property is the data for housing starts and building permits. This publicly available data shows you the number of new homes being constructed in a certain area, which can help you determine whether an area is being overbuilt, underbuilt, or right on track. An area that is declining or holding steady in population but rapidly expanding in housing starts or building permits could indicate higher vacancy in the future because supply will outpace demand. To research housing starts and or building permit applications, check out the U.S. Census Bureau's new residential construction data, which is free at www.census.gov/construction/NRC, or the National Association of Home Builders site, which is paid at www.nahb.org. Transportation. If you want to rent to good people who have good jobs, you'll likely want to invest in areas where those people can get to work. Although it is entirely possible to invest in rental properties in rural areas, as I do. Your choice of the best tenants will increase if you are in an area where good tenants can travel to work reasonably easy. Look for locations with close access to mass public transit. My good friend and fellow Bigger Pockets member Darren Sager recommends buying properties within walking distance of the local train, because economic growth tends to follow the rail. But even if your area doesn't have a light rail or a train, look for places within a moderate commute to major centers of employment. Proximity to local businesses. When seeking a good economic market, why reinvent the wheel? Consider this. When Starbucks decides to open a new store, do you think they do their research? Well, how about Walmart or Costco? Of course they do. Large businesses like these spend millions of dollars a year doing research on every aspect of a community before deciding to invest their money into a new store there. Therefore, it would make sense that if Starbucks or other national businesses begin to invest in an area, it might be a good area for you to consider. This is also helpful because your tenant will want local businesses to shop at, and if they have to travel 30 minutes to get their tall, extra hot peppermint hot chocolate with whip, but no mocha drizzle, it might be a bit tougher to find a tenant. Price to rent ratios. One of the most popular numbers people like to consider when analyzing a location is the price to rent ratio. In other words, what is the average ratio of the median monthly rent divided by the median purchase price? If that confuses you, let me break it down a little further. So the median sales price of an area is the point at which half the properties are more expensive and half the properties are less expensive. You can find this data in a number of places, but I found the most accurate figures at www.zillow.com/research/data, where you can download a massive amount of data about nearly every zip code in America. Scroll down to the other metrics section and click on data in the zip code column. As you can see at biggerpockets.com/rental-book-figures. You'll be able to download a CSV, comma separated values file, which you can open with Excel or Google Docs, and you can see the current and historical median sales price data for almost every zip code in the country. Find your local median sales price by searching for your zip code and write that number down somewhere. Then head back to zillow.com/research/data, and under Zillow Rent Index, download the data in the row marked All Homes in the zip code column. Then simply find your zip code and look at the column representing the most current quarter, all the way to the right. There, you will find the median rental price for your zip code. To find the price to rent ratio, simply divide the first number by the second. So, the price to rent ratio is the median monthly rental price divided by the median sales price. If this sounds familiar to you, we talked about the 2% rule or the 2% test back a few chapters ago. This is the exact same concept. We're just looking at it from a larger picture. In my area, according to the data from Zillow, I found my median monthly rental price is $839, and my median sales price is $106,846.15. Therefore, my price to rent ratio is 0.7%. Now that I've showed you how to calculate this number, let me explain why you may not want to even use it. As with any calculation, everything comes down to the data you input. Garbage in, garbage out. In the case of my area, I know that this data might be technically correct, but I also know it doesn't take into account numerous factors. For example, it doesn't separate out the properties in the lower income areas of the zip code. It doesn't look at the condition of the property. It doesn't distinguish between properties of different sizes or number of bedrooms. It doesn't look at a lot of things. When I purchase a single family house in my area, I typically will pay approximately $50,000 for the home, which will rent for around $750 a month. This is a price to rent ratio of 1.5%, double what the data showed. So keep in mind that although this data does have some use, especially in comparing one area with another, you must take this information with a grain of salt and look at properties with specifics, not averages, or you might miss out on a great location simply because of bad data. Vacancy rates. You heard me mention the concept of vacancy rates a few times thus far in this book. The term denotes the percentage of a year that a property will sit empty. It is a very important calculation to include in your numbers when you buy a rental property, but it is also an average number that you should consider when determining the best location in which to purchase a rental property. Buying in an area with a high average vacancy rate means that your property will likely be vacant more often. Because vacancy is one of the most costly expenses for a landlord, it would make sense that you would want to buy in an area with below average vacancy rates. So how do you find an area's average vacancy rate? Well, there are three different approaches to finding this data. First, the census. The U.S. Census Bureau tracks vacancy rates with data points in many areas of the country, including the largest 75 markets in the country. This data is fairly raw and will require you to download information to a spreadsheet to analyze it. This data also does not get down to the level of specific neighborhoods, which can dramatically affect the vacancy rate. So for now, let's just skip that one. Number two, real estate agents. If your specific location uses real estate agents to fill vacant units, you can call in a favor and ask a local real estate agent to conduct a comparative market analysis on local rental property stats. This can show you how long currently available properties on the MLS have been vacant. This will also show you how long properties sat before being rented, original listing prices versus rented price, and other data points. And number three, property managers or other landlords. The third, and in my opinion, the far best approach to finding an area's vacancy rate is by calling up the local property manager or a large landlord with number of units, not body fat, and asking them. They should know this number off the top of their head and can probably give you a more accurate picture than either of the other options listed here. Property managers can tell you specifics about which streets or neighborhoods have a higher or lower vacancy, as well as other nuances about locations. In addition, this gives you the chance to interview some property managers over the phone in case you decide you want to hire one to watch over your investments. So, what is a good vacancy rate? Well, the truth is, there is no standard right or wrong number. But according to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 2014, the nationwide average was 7.6%, compared with a record high of 10.6% in 2009 and a record low of 5% in 1981. Your area will likely have a different number, and honestly, that is okay. No matter what the vacancy rate is for your area, the truth is this. Make sure you incorporate this vacancy rate into your analysis. Furthermore, know that vacancy rates are largely affected by the way you manage a property. I'll talk more about the specifics of lowering your vacancy rate later in the book, but consider this. The average vacancy rate in my area hovers around 6-8%, but in my company, we run under 2% all year round. Of course, when I analyze a deal, I'm sure to include 6-8% vacancy rate, knowing that I will not always be the one managing my properties so efficiently. Property tax and insurance rates. Finally, as with vacancy rates, every location has different taxes and insurance rates, and this is something that you should be both aware of when purchasing and including in your estimates when analyzing a property. Some areas of the country have surprisingly low property tax rates, like Denver, for example, while other areas have exceptionally high rates, much of the northeastern areas of the country. The same is true for insurance rates, because some areas require higher insurance rates as a result of the weather or climate. Florida, for example, tends to have higher insurance rates because of hurricanes. Also, be sure to consider whether or not the area you are considering is located in a 100-year floodplain. This is a designation given by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, for areas that have a 1% probability or greater within a 100-year time frame of flooding. If you buy a property in such an area, any bank or traditional lender will require you to have flood insurance on the property, because traditional insurance policies do not cover damage caused by floods. Flood insurance is required on several of my properties, and trust me, it can add a significant expense. Furthermore, the future cost of flood insurance is a political issue because it is currently subsidized by the U.S. government, which keeps prices down for those who are required to have it. Recently, the cost of flood insurance has been fluctuating because the government subsidy ended and a patch was applied to Congress to kick the can down the road a bit. The possibility of future hikes is a real danger. So, what is my advice on buying in an area that requires flood insurance? I can't say not to do it because some of my best properties are located in these kind of areas. The property's location in a flood zone is one of the reasons I was able to get such a good deal. It is just imperative that you include the cost of flood insurance in your estimates and plan for that price to increase over time. Furthermore, look into the actual risk of the property. For example, I purchased a triplex last year in a flood zone But the property's first floor was physically 15 feet off the ground, so I had little to worry about. That said, I will also caution you with this. For years, everyone laughed at the idea of a flood in my area, and we joked about the whole flood insurance thing being unnecessary. Until this past winter, when that once-in-a-100-year flood hit my town, we received 7 inches of rain in 24 hours, overflowing the city's water control systems and flooding the town. I spent the morning walking through 3 feet of rainwater, checking out my properties, and, in total, ended up with about $5,000 worth of damage. Now, my deductible on the flood insurance was $5,000 per property, so the insurance didn't even help, but I escaped relatively easy. All of this is to say that you must understand that floods in a floodplain are a very real possibility. So if you are considering investing in rental properties in this kind of location, plan for the worst and hope for the best. Moving on. I don't know what your location is like, so I can't craft the perfect investment strategy for you. However, you now have all the tools needed to go out and research your prospective location to fully understand what you're getting into. Success through real estate investing can be found in really any location, but only if you understand that location. So take the time needed to dig in, get the facts, understand the location, and then build your plan around that. After you've studied your market, it is time to take action and begin shopping for a great deal. Therefore, in the next chapter, I'll dive into the concept of finding great real estate deals within that market. Chapter 9, How to Find Rental Properties. Abraham Lincoln once said, "Things may come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." An ancient proverb tells the story of a young man who wanted to jump over a hill. In preparation for this feat, he trained night and day for many months. He worked on his leg muscles, ate the right food, talked with others who had made the same jump, and he visualized success. On the day of the big jump, he stood facing the hill, determined to make the jump a success. He knew that he would need a good running start, so he backed up. And then he backed up some more. Then he backed up some more until he could barely see the hill. Then with all his effort, he took off like a rocket, running at full speed. He ran so fast and so hard that by the time he made it to the hill, he was too tired to make the jump, so he stopped, gave up, and went home. The first 8 chapters of this book have been a warm-up. You've done your stretching, your preparation, your education. You've likely flipped the switch and you have fully decided that rental properties will be the key to your success. You've nailed down a niche that you want to enter, and you've begun building your plan for buy and hold domination. You even know how to analyze a location and a deal to make sure the investment is solid. But up until this point, it has all been talk, preparation, and backing up. I firmly believe that everything you've done so far has been necessary, but like the young man in the story, this is often as far as many new investors make it in their journey. They prepare, and then they give up. But not you. For you, the time has come to stop just preparing and start running towards the hill. And it's time to jump. In this chapter, I'll focus on how you can find a great rental property with which to start building your future wealth. I'll talk about 8 different ways you can find investment properties, starting with the most common, the MLS. Number 1, the MLS. The MLS, or Multiple Listing Service, is a collection of all homes listed for sale by real estate agents in your area. In truth, the MLS is not one specific list, but rather hundreds of lists from different, smaller MLSs across the country. In the years before modern technology, agents would pass around a physical copy of this list so that other agents in the area would know what was on the market in that area. Today, however, the internet has simplified the process dramatically. Now, all the little MLSs have been combined into one master list we commonly refer to as simply the MLS. Now, before you jump into your computer and try to download the list for yourself, understand that you can't. At least, not completely. The MLS is a tool owned and used by licensed real estate agents. So unless you or your spouse have your license, you will have to start your search elsewhere. Several websites allow you to search some of the MLS, such as Realtor.com, Zillow.com, Trulia.com, or Redfin.com. However, none of these offer the full picture of what is actually available in a given area. To get the most up-to-date, correct, and complete data, you must access the MLS directly through an agent. It is a slightly annoying process to always have to go through a third party, and this is the primary reason why many investors get their real estate license. However, if you don't have your license and don't plan to get it in the near future, Well, you'll need to deal with this. Your agent will send over real estate deals, hopefully automatically and electronically, that fit what you might be seeking, as mentioned earlier when I discussed working with an agent. Your agent will likely send you a link to a website that has more information about a property, usually including photos, property specifics, and other data that will help you decide if the property is worth pursuing. At this point, the ball is in your court to decide whether the property is worth looking at in more depth. If you toured every single property you came across, you'd waste a lot of time, and your agent would probably stop working with you. Instead, you will do some quick math and make some quick decisions based on what the numbers, location, and property type are. If the property seems to have potential, you may want to set up a showing to check it out as soon as possible. Or, if you have time, perhaps you drive to the property right then and there to investigate further. A few nights ago, my agent sent me a listing that he thought I would be interested in, and I was. After some quick number crunching at home, I jumped in my car to go dig in a little further, since I was unfamiliar with the area. I discovered a lot just by looking at the outside of the property and peering in the windows. Don't worry, it was a vacant HUD property. I made my decision that night to pursue the property, and I set up a time with my agent to see it, and I made an offer. I typically look at several dozen properties per week on the computer screen, but I actually only physically look at maybe 1 in 100. There are simply too many bad deals on the MLS. It doesn't mean that you can't find them there, though. In fact, the vast majority of the properties I have purchased have been on the MLS. You just need to be smart. Let me share with you my top 10 list for getting a great deal on the MLS. Number 1, find a great agent. A great agent who is also fast and motivated is key to success on the MLS. Because there is such high competition for properties on the MLS, you will need someone who is responsive and will get the job done. If you can't find this person, consider becoming an agent yourself. Number 2, set up automatic alerts. With the help of your agent, be sure to set up automatic alerts about properties when they come on the market or drop in price. I have an automatic alert set so that any multifamily in my area will be emailed to me immediately, as well as any house under 100,000 in my town. This way, I can check it out right away. Number 3, quickly screen out the duds. Most of the properties on those automatic alerts won't be good enough, so learn to quickly screen out the bad ones. This will save you both you and your agent a lot of time, so you can focus on the small percentage of deals that will be worth pursuing. This is really when things like the 50% rule or the 1 or 2% rule or test come in handy, which we talked about in a previous chapter. Number 4, be faster than the rest. Again, your success using the MLS is strictly tied to your ability to be fast. You may not have the highest or best offer on a property, but if you get an in before the other guys, you might just hear a yes before the competition has even looked at the property. Too late for them. Number 5, look for hidden value add opportunities. Look for properties that can be changed slightly to increase their value dramatically. For example, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before in this book, but I'll say it again. I love finding 2-bedroom houses and turning them into 3-bedroom houses. This is not always possible, of course, but many 2-bedroom homes have an extra bonus room or an attic that can be converted this way, and huge equity can be added through that conversion. This is just one example of something that most people don't see, but if you can envision the possibilities, you can take a mediocre property that most people would pass on and turn it into an incredible deal. Number 6, make a lot of offers and fail often. Finding great deals on the MLS is largely a numbers game. You are playing with statistics when trying to find that one deal that provide great cash flow. Perhaps only 1 in 100 deals are worth buying, so you need to look at 100 properties on paper or on your screen before you offer on one. And because most properties for which you submit an offer won't work out, you'll need to probably offer often and fail often. That's right, fail often. A wise investor once told me that if he gets more than 1 in 10 offers accepted, he knows he is offering too much. Although that ratio may be different for you, the point of his statement is solid. Don't be afraid to submit a lot of offers. Number 7, look for old listings. While speed is incredibly helpful when buying on the MLS, as we just talked about, the opposite end of that spectrum can also be a goldmine for investors to find hidden deals. Old listings. If you've ever tried to sell a home, you'll understand what I mean when I say it is stressful. There's always that worry that your property won't sell, you'll be stuck holding it forever. Therefore, the longer a property sits on the MLS without an offer, the better chance you'll have of getting a great deal. And the longer it sits on the MLS, the more home searchers forget about it. It is no longer the cute new kid in school. It's just another overpriced property that most people are ignoring. And as a result, it might just be your ticket to getting a deal put together that makes financial sense. Number 8, focus on distressed. When buying a property on the MLS, focus on the deals that need some work. I've already talked about this, the pros and cons of buying a fixer-upper, so I don't need to belabor the point, but remember that homes that have some kind of problem are the ones that 90% of the home buyers out there are avoiding. So hone in on those for the best chance at a deal. Number 9, make your offer clean. A clean offer is one without a lot of contingencies. I'll discuss contingencies more in depth later, but a contingency in an offer is a legal reason to back out. The more contingency you have in your offer, the less inclined the seller is to accept it. Common contingencies include the inspection contingency, which allows you to back out if you uncover something bad about the property's condition during the inspection, or the financing contingency, which allows you to back out if you can't get financing. I'm not telling you to necessarily remove those contingencies, especially if you are new to the game, because they help you limit risk. However, understand that the more contingencies you have in your offer, the less inclined the seller will be to accept. Imagine that a seller receives 2 offers, one from you with numerous contingencies that would allow you to back out of the deal anytime before closing for almost any reason, and another offer with no contingencies. The seller would likely choose the cleaner offer with no contingencies because they don't want to be jerked around even if the cleaner offer was for less. Therefore, keep your offer as clean as possible to increase your chance of getting an acceptance. Number 10, work when no one else is working. Finally, when dealing with the MLS, make it your goal to submit offers when your competition is relaxing. BiggerPockets contributor and real estate investor Mark Ferguson often talks about the success he has had by offering on deals on Friday, when most agents and investors have already begun wrapping up for the week and are planning their weekend fishing trips or barbecue. By the time Monday rolls around, the other agents and investors start working, he's already got the contract accepted and the property tied up. He's already getting his inspection scheduled. This same principle applies to holidays and especially to the end of the year. Most people see the time between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day as holiday time, so they work half as hard. Savvy investors, however, know that this is the best time of the year to find deals for 2 reasons. 1, during this season, banks are in a hurry to unload their properties before the new year. And 2, there's just a lot less competition for properties. The MLS can be a great source of deals for a real estate investor, but because of the sheer quantity of deals and the number of competitors, you need to be both fast and smart. As real estate investing becomes more and more popular, the MLS will become more and more difficult to find deals on. Even terrible deals will be snatched up quickly because people generally have no idea what makes a good deal. Therefore, you may need to expand your horizons and look elsewhere for a deal. And that is what I'll focus on for the rest of this chapter. Number 2, direct mail marketing for deals. One of the most common methods used by house flippers and wholesalers to find deals, yet neglected by nearly all rental property investors, is using direct mail marketing. Direct mail is the act of sending out a large number of targeted letters or postcards to people who might be interested in selling their property. Knowing that only a small percentage will call you to talk more about the possibility, and that a small percentage of those will end up actually selling you the properties. While this may seem to be a lost cause, direct mail marketers know that the proof is in the percentages. If they can get, for example, 5% of those mailed to call them, and if they can buy, for example, 5% of the homes of the people who call, they can still make far more than those letters or postcards cost. Let's just say that a wannabe landlord sends out 1,000 letters and had 5% of those people call for more information, resulting in 50 phone calls. Now, let's just say that 5% of those 50 phone calls resulted in a property being purchased, or 2.5 homes. But since you can't really purchase half a home, we'll round down to 2 homes. So the question is, could you spend the money needed to send 1,000 letters if you knew that you were going to buy 2 properties? If those deals are as financially solid as they should be, I hope your answer is yes, Now, keep in mind, these numbers are hypothetical, and every direct mail campaign will have different results based on numerous factors. So it's easy to see why flippers and wholesalers might do direct mail, because they get repaid right away when they sell the home. Buy and hold investors, on the other hand, do not quickly sell, so they don't see that money spent returning to them so soon, which explains the lack of use of this tactic among rental property investors. However, if you consider the cost of direct mail just part of your investment, so think of it as additional closing costs or additional repairs, then it's hard to not want to try this method. So who is actually saying yes to selling you their properties? Typically, these are motivated people who can't or won't sell with a real estate agent. It might be someone caught in a nasty divorce who is just trying to liquidate the property as fast as possible. It might be someone who is in danger of losing the home to foreclosure. It might be someone who inherited the house but doesn't want it. It might be someone who tried to be a landlord but failed miserably and now has a deadbeat tenant who won't pay rent and won't leave. Do you see a pattern here? Direct mail marketing is about finding people with problems and helping solve their problems. You are not taking advantage of anyone or trying to trick anyone into selling their house. You are simply canvassing a large number of people and trying to find those with whom you can find a win-win solution for all parties. There are a number of different contact lists you can buy and mail to, but the most common is the absentee list. This means that the person on record for owning a property does not actually live in the property. You can find and purchase these lists from companies like ListSource.com or MelissaData.com, and then send letters, postcards, or whatever you think will work best to secure your deal. Typically, you'll spend approximately 60 cents for each postcard and approximately a dollar for each letter, but this can depend on how much work you do yourself and how much you outsource. One final note about direct mail marketing. Success is found in repetition. It is unlikely that the person you mail to this month will respond with an immediate yes. Trust and brand recognition needs to be built first. We've all heard it said that before someone buys a product from a company, they need 8 interactions with that brand. The same is true for your direct mail, so I encourage you to mail regularly to the same list. Some direct mail marketers send letters monthly to the same list, while others send quarterly. You will likely find a solution that works well for you, but again, the point is this. Repetition is key. If John Homeowner gets a letter from you every month for a year, and he suddenly realizes he needs to sell fast, who do you think he's going to call? Some stranger from an ugly yellow sign taped to a telephone pole by the laundromat? Or you, the company that has been reaching out to him for the last 12 months? For a more in-depth guide looking at direct mail marketing, check out The Ultimate Guide to Using Direct Mail Advertising to Grow Your Real Estate Business, which you can get for free at www.biggerpockets.com/directmail. Number 3, driving for dollars. Have you ever been driving in your car and noticed a house that made you think, boy, that house needs some work? If so, then you are already proficient at driving for dollars. Driving for dollars is the practice of getting in your car and driving up and down the streets of a neighborhood that you want to invest in, looking for potential deals. Then you simply try to buy those properties. But what does a deal even look like? Well, typically, when you're driving for dollars, you want to focus on properties that look distressed, vacant, or transitioning negatively. For example, a property with an 18-inch high grass indicates that somebody probably doesn't care about the property much. A mailbox stuffed with old, wet pieces of mail shows that someone might not be living there. A tarp on the roof that seems to have been there a while shows that the house might have some problems that the owner can't afford to fix. While driving in the neighborhoods where you want to buy, you'll likely encounter dozens of potential properties. Write down the address of each and every one, including some notes about the condition, and snap a photo as well. When you get home, do some digging into the public records to see who owns the property. Many times, you can even do a reverse phone number search to get the owner's number. Or perhaps you just want to write a letter offering to buy the property and mail to the owner's address listed in the tax records. Driving for dollars is one of the lowest cost methods of finding potential properties because it involves nothing but a tank of gas and your time, which makes it great for those who are looking to get started investing in real estate but have limited funds to find deals. It can also help you get to know your prospective neighborhoods really well, which will help you make smarter decisions about your real estate. Number four, eviction records. I will never forget my first eviction. Cockroaches?